off to, Jed?
Got to take care of my Uncle Pete.
Thought you buried him last month.
Sure did, but we had to dig him up twice to make room for oil wells.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, August 25th, 1946, we present the 40th in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
oil, our deepest frontier.
This is Robert St. John in New York. This issue of the National Hour goes underground, but not in a political or a subway sense. Our investigation concerns rather a prosaic, yet a powerful and fortune-making product, oil. In the course of our investigation, we shall call upon expert opinion from Mr. Eugene Holman, president of the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, who will answer the question, is this country running out of oil?
And this is Robert McCormick in Washington. Oil is not only one of our greatest industries, but our most powerful natural resource, as recent memories of A and B cards will remind us. Therefore, to tell us what is being done about oil conservation and exploration, we shall bring you Senator Joseph C. O'Mahony of Wyoming. We are standing by.
So, at last, this is what I've been hearing about all these years. Sunny California.
This is just a slight sample of heaven, Yankee boy. This is just the beginning.
Well, you just show me, native son. I'm open-minded.
You won't be after we get out on the boat and you start reeling them in.
Hey, Jerry, look.
What's wrong, guy?
Look, out there, a mirage.
I don't see. Where?
Right out there in the ocean. Don't you see them? A mirage, those oil wells. Well, what's the matter? Don't you see them?
Sure, but it's no mirage. That's tideland, son.
You mean they get oil from under the water?
Yes, sir.
Well, what do you know? Oil from under the ocean.
Oil from under the ocean. Well, son of a gun. Have a cigar.
Oh, no, thanks. I'll stick to my pipe.
Well, I know how it is with you pipe men. I guess that was a pun. You know, you smoke in a pipe and then you use pipelines for running oil. There's a light.
Yeah, thanks.
Say, tell me, how far out there in the tidelands do you have to go to get oil?
Well, fields my company works are about a mile offshore.
You don't mean out in the ocean?
Mm-hmm, right out in the Pacific.
Son of a gun.
We've had wells there for almost 30 years now.
Oil fields under the ocean. Brother, now I've heard everything. Say, who does that land belong to?
Well, that's a big question mark right now.
What do you mean?
Congress passed a resolution a couple of weeks back saying that the land belonged to the state of California. The president has just vetoed it.
Yeah, that's tough. What happens now?
The Supreme Court will have to decide who owns that land, California or the USA.
What'll you do in the meantime?
Go on bringing up oil. If the court decides against the state, it just means we'll have a change of landlord.
With the president's veto of the Tidelands resolution 3 weeks ago, oil once again came prominently to the nation's attention. But Tidelands is merely a link in the fabulous chain that binds oil and America. Now, in A.D. 1946, oil is a three-letter word for industrial power. And this definition was shaped in the last 87 years. For 88 years ago, there wasn't a single oil-producing well anywhere in America or in the world. And yet oil was known in a small town in western Pennsylvania.
Step closer, ladies and gentlemen. Step closer, if you please, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, what you selling there, mister? Water from the Fountain of Youth?
No, sir. I'm selling rock oil from the Fountain of Youth. A sovereign remedy known only to the Seneca Indians for hundreds of years. And now, for the first time, it comes to you from 400 feet below the Earth's surface, bottled in its natural state, without any preparation or admixture.
Seems you went to a lot of trouble, mister. What's it good for?
What's it good for, yes? Why, bless you, sir. This oil is a singularly beneficial and infallible cure for headaches, toothaches, rheumatism, lung diseases, cuts, burns, and all human complaints. No family should be without a bottle. It is also good for saddle burns and scratches in horses. This helpful balm from nature's secret spring will bring the bloom of health and life to every man.
Is this the rock oil you bought from the peddler?
The very same. I sent several bottles for analysis without opening. I became interested, gentlemen, when I found out that this oil can be burned in lamps. If there is some way to get enough of it, we can sell it cheaper than whale oil or coal oil. I should think you gentlemen would be interested in the investment possibilities.
Indeed I am, Mr. Bissell.
You may count me in, sir. Well, Mr. Bissell, I believe you submitted this oil for expert chemical analysis.
I did, sir.
Mr. Bissell, who made the tests you mentioned?
The eminent professor of chemistry at Yale University, Professor Benjamin Silliman, Jr.
Oh.
If I may, I should like to read from his report.
Well, by all means, sir.
I can promise you that the result will meet your expectations of the value of this material for many useful purposes. I am having them tried on watches and fine machinery. However, my present tests indicate that the value of this oil depends mostly on its properties as an illuminant. Well, gentlemen, will you invest to dig for this oil?
I'll go in it.
I'll put up my money.
Count me in, too.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. You won't regret it. We'll get leases on that land at once.
And we'll have to get a man to boss a crew for the digging.
I think I have the right man. Drake is his name. Edwin L. Drake. He lives in New Haven.
Drake? Never heard of him.
Who is he? What's he do?
Well, gentlemen, actually, the last thing he did before he took sick was being a conductor on the New York and New Haven.
A train conductor?
Are you quite sure he's the man for us, Mr. Bissell?
I can understand your uncertainty, but this is a completely new field we're entering. I've spoken to Drake many times. He impresses me with his sense and his ability to handle men. Most important, he has faith in our project. He has invested $200 of his own savings.
I don't doubt your judgment, sir, but a train conductor would hardly inspire the required confidence among skeptical investors.
I've thought of that too, Mr. Townsend. I propose that we forget Mr. Drake's worthy but unexciting past. We'll send him to Titusville with the imposing title of Colonel.
Was 1858. In the northwest corner of Pennsylvania in the Allegheny foothills, a short distance above the point where Pine Creek flows into Oil Creek, was the village of Titusville, population 300. Here, Colonel Drake came to dig for oil. And after long, patient months of digging...
All I can tell you, Mr. Bissell, is that there's oil under this land. The natives say there ought to be oil because the land's no good for anything else.
But the point is, we're not getting the oil. The stockholders are beginning to grouch. What's wrong, Drake?
The soil. It's spongy. Every time we start digging a hole, we don't get more than 16 feet and the sides cave in. Or else we strike water and we're flooded.
All right, that happens in the spongy ground. Have you tried digging in solid ground?
We did that and we got salt water.
Well, I'm afraid we can't afford to pay out more money. Drake, you'll have to find a way of getting to the oil and you'd better do it mighty soon.
Wait a minute. Mr. Bissell, I just thought of something. We've been going at this all wrong.
What do you mean, all wrong?
One thing that makes the salt fellas hopping mad is to find their wells are bringing up oil.
What has that to do with us?
Just this. Salt men drill their wells. They don't dig them. Up to now, I've been digging. But suppose now we drill, deep enough to hit oil. Keep it going.
No use. She'll cave in again like the last dozen times.
Keep the drill going. Hey, why did you stop?
Well, you hit rock, Colonel.
How far down?
39.5 feet. Got to put in a different shaft to punch through that rock.
We pull this shaft, she'll cave in again.
Always has in this ground. Want to try it?
Wait a minute. Where are the pipes you used to drain off the salt water?
There's a heap of them over by the wagon.
Get them over here.
What for, Colonel?
We'll sink that pipe down to the rock, and then we'll drill through it.
What are you driving at?
That iron pipe will be a casing to keep the hole from caving in.
Well, Colonel, that's a new one anyway.
Well, maybe it's the one we've been looking for.
For my text this morning, I have chosen 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19. Ye are not your own. Ye were bought with a price.
Excuse me, Reverend. I thought you might want to give your blessing. Colonel Drake just struck oil!
The day was Sunday, August 27th, 1859. 87 years to the day this coming Tuesday. And for the world, the news of the 69.5-foot hole in Titusville, Pennsylvania, was as astounding and prickling to men's minds as was the news of an explosion in the desert in Alamogordo, New Mexico, 86 years later.
I saw it with my own eyes. Drake pumped 25 barrels in the first 24 hours. $16.80 a barrel. Tell Lodge to sell everything and come on out here. It's greater than...
From California, ocean lake to old Virginia shore, and from the Gulf of Mexico to northern Labrador, all o'er the land the word is now petroleum all the while. And all the bores and the bores in choir have you struck isle. Hurrah, hurrah, rich treasures in our sile. What care we if all Europe rage our nation has struck isle?
By stagecoach, by team, on horseback and on foot, they flocked by the thousands into the oil country. They came to see what was going on and what there might be for them. Up and down the creek they went, buying land and leasing land.
Where are you off to, Jed?
Got to take care of Uncle Pete.
I thought you buried him last month.
We sure did, but we had to dig him up twice to make room for oil wells.
Well, what are you going to do with him now?
Well, I'm fixing to ship him off to Rochester, New York. He'll lie peaceably there.
But yesterday that man was poor who's now a millionaire. For on his lands deemed worthless then are found oil wells most rare. His neighbors all now half run mad or boring through the sile. And all the agitous signs they seek all hoping to strike isle. Hooray, hooray, rich treasure.
Into the oil land swarmed the speculators, the promoters, the combine makers, the exploiters of land and men. And from the oil lands came the great breed of wildcatters, the men who drilled wells and moved on, the men who drilled wells just as others paint pictures or build bridges or write books. They are to oil what prospectors are to gold. And let's ask an old-time wildcatter about his life in the oil fields. In Long Beach, California, Mr. Grover C. Stafford is a wildcat oil man of 40 years standing. And let's go to him for some of the more colorful aspects of the oil business.
This is Doug Gourlay in California. Beside me is a man who has been in the oil game for 40 years, Grover C. Stafford, drilling foreman. Did you ever bring in a gusher, Mr. Stafford?
Yes, but we don't use the term gusher. To an oil man, a well that has enough gas pressure to make the oil flow freely of its own accord is simply a flowing well.
Out of 40 years, what experience do you recall most vividly?
Well, one time when we were drilling well, the drilling bit penetrated a gas stratum. The gas pressure was so strong that it blew 2.5 tons of drilling tools right out of the hole and out through the top of the dirt.
You mean 2.5 tons of equipment flew out of the hole and sailed right by you?
That's right, twice. Once going up and once coming down.
Where did you start in the oil game?
In Colingo, California, in 1907. I had a friend there and went to work with him when I came out from Tennessee.
What stands out as the greatest change in oil drilling since you started?
Well, here's one. When I started, it took a year and a half to drill a well to a depth of 3,600 feet. Now we can drill that deep in 6 days.
Thank you, Grover C. Stafford, an oil man for 40 years. This is Doug Gourlay in California. We return you to the National Hour in New York.
Deep in the earth, Americans discovered a new frontier. Men packed up their families or kissed them goodbye and went off to Wildcat for oil. We drilled wells in Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Kansas. For every 6 wells sunk, only 1 gave oil. But oil is where you find it. And we found it in Oklahoma, West Virginia, Michigan, Montana, New Mexico.
In 1859, 1 well produced 2,000 barrels of petroleum. In 1899, over 69,000 wells produced 57 million barrels.
Get the oil out! Keep those pumps going!
The whole world's crying for oil! Keep it coming! Light up the field, we'll work around the clock!
Through 100,000 mouths, the earth yielded oil. Farmers and school teachers, teamsters and cobblers sought oil as if it were the gold. Fortunes were made and fortunes were lost.
Now, how about furnishings for the new house, Mr. Jarvis?
Well, now, I haven't had much time to think about the doodads. You don't get to know about those things pushing a plow.
Now, we'll be glad to do all the buying and house decoration for you, sir.
Well, just see that it's the best and get it from Chicago or New York or Paris. But you got to get me the best, and a lot of it.
Of course, Mr. Jarvis, of course.
Father!
What's wrong, boy?
I've been hunting you all over.
What's happened?
The well. She stopped flowing.
Boy, you're joking.
I saw it happen. The oil stopped coming up. Then all we could get was water. And then nothing. Nothing at all.
We must have done something that was wrong. But what was it we did wrong? What was it? What was it we did wrong, Professor? I came all the way out here to the college because I heard about you, and I thought maybe you'd know.
Well, Mr. Jarvis, we geologists are learning about the strange ways of oil just as you wildcatters are learning. We don't know all the answers, just as we don't yet know all the problems.
But what I've told you, can you give me an explanation?
Well, yes, I can. You worked that well of yours too hard.
Too hard?
You didn't know, but you shortened the life and productivity of your well.
Yes?
And it happened pretty much like this. Down underground, there's a very delicate balance between oil and gas and water.
Yes?
When you withdraw the oil too fast, you destroy the balance.
I see.
Water gets into the well ahead of the oil, and the oil is lost to you and cannot be recovered.
Oh, well, it makes sense, all right. But I never heard of such before. And maybe if I had, I wouldn't have done much different. It's mighty hard to turn off the tap when the gold is flowing.
Thus, slowly and painfully, we began to learn about the word conservation. But before we learned that lesson, we kept the taps wide open and the gold flowed free. And when wells gave out, we just moved on and drilled others.
We've got to put a stop to this endless drilling.
Ah, quit crying calamity. This'll go on forever.
But we're taking something from the earth we can't replace. Every day we pump out what took a million years to put there.
But we went on. We drilled wells and brought forth oil from the earth in Wyoming and Kentucky and Louisiana and Arkansas.
In 1929, we had 328,000 wells. Out of them, we pumped 2,800,000 barrels of oil daily.
In floods, the oil flowed to the refineries, and then it flowed out to America and the world as gasoline and kerosene, grease and asphalt, oil for lubrication and oil for fuel, the lifeblood and the vitamins of the machines of the world. 60% of the world's needs flowed from the wells of America. And then, on December the 7th, 1941, oil became a weapon.
You want I should park her, Mr. Taylor?
Nah, put her in storage. I can't run her without gas.
Get Washington on the wire. Tell him we've got the machines installed and the men hired, but we've got to have oil and gasoline and grease to start running.
On five continents, we fought a war of machines. Production machines and destruction machines. Oil went to war in 1,000 different uniforms. It carried our men to battle. It fired their weapons. It kept them alive.
Of every 3 tons of war material shipped overseas, 2 tons were oil and its products.
Oil was the power and the lubrication for planes and tanks, ships, trucks, jeeps, and oil went into synthetic rubber and into TNT and bombs, shells, torpedoes. Oil went into smoke screens, into waterproof tents, and into killing the malarial mosquito.
And from the wells of America, oil flowed to the machines of war across the anti-Axis world.
To speed the flow, we built the Big Inch and the Little Big Inch pipelines. From 39 to 44, we doubled the load flowing in our pipelines.
We went into the war, and our wells were yielding 4 million barrels of oil each day. In 1944, the flow was 5 million.
In partnership with the federal government, the oil industry helped fight and win a war. Now, in the first year of peace, we slow down a little and begin to take stock. Now, after 4 years of maximum production of oil, the often asked question arises once more. Now, in a world in which oil is as vital as air, the question persists. How much longer can we look to the earth for oil? The National Hour puts this question to Mr. Eugene Holman, president of the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey. Mr. Holman, how much longer can we look to the earth for oil?
The earth will continue to give us oil for generations. In the United States alone, we estimate that there is as much oil remaining to be found as has already been produced since the industry began. The resources of the rest of the world, which are much greater than ours, are still largely undeveloped.
Well, what do you think the oil situation of this country will be in, say, 20 years?
The oil industry expects its proved reserves, that is, its known underground working stocks, to be as great in 20 years as they are today.
How can that be? We'll be using oil all along, won't we?
Yes, but we'll also continue to find it. During the war, our efforts returned to production while exploration lagged. But today, oil explorers are hard at work uncovering new sources, and we are certain that oil will continue to be found in large quantities.
If our reserves in 20 years are to be as great as they are now, well, then that means that we must find as much oil as we can use, doesn't it?
Yes, that is true. But not all of this oil need come from our own soil. In order to satisfy the demands of the future without drawing too heavily upon our own reserves, this country will have to depend partly on imports. But these will not compete with the domestic oil. Instead, they will supplement production at home and enable the industry to stay strong and keep its reserves at a safe level. As a matter of fact, we shall never actually run out of oil. Should natural supplies show sign of diminishing, we shall utilize other sources to an increasing extent. In addition to imports, there are, for example, natural gas, coal, and oil shales to draw upon. In the long run, coal alone offers an almost inexhaustible domestic source of oil products. The conversion of these products to oil is perfectly feasible and awaits only the economic need.
Well, what you say, Mr. Holman, is certainly reassuring. But what about national emergencies, which would demand sudden increases far beyond normal production?
No oil man thinks of this country's future without considering the possibility of national emergencies. On such occasions, we would, of course, have to draw much more heavily on our reserves. That is one of the main reasons why we must maintain a healthy, progressive oil industry.
And on the whole, then, you are optimistic about the future of oil.
Yes. We in the oil industry are optimistic. We intend to keep on looking for new oil. We expect to make the production and use of oil more and more efficient. We want the country to get better products and plenty of them at lower prices. Oil means too much to our entire civilization for us even to contemplate a shortage. Today, our oil position is sound. We want to keep it that way.
Well, thank you, Mr. Holman. As we've just heard, a major factor in maintaining our oil position is in seeking new reserves. For senatorial comment on the subject of exploring fresh reserves of petroleum, we go to Denver and to Senator Joseph C. O'Mahony of Wyoming, author of a new law to promote the search for oil and also chairman of a special Senate Petroleum Committee.
It was a partnership between the government and the petroleum industry, which, as Mr. St. John has so well said, enabled the United States to supply the oil that won the war. Now again, the government is entering another partnership with the petroleum industry to stimulate the search for much-needed new reserves upon the public domain. The government, through the Department of the Interior, is the custodian of the vast public domain which in the Rocky Mountain states, Wyoming, New Mexico, Montana, Colorado, and California, embraces 300,000 square miles of potential oil-bearing land, not yet fully tested. The industry is made up of energetic and venturesome men who, as individuals and through organizations, both big and little, have the courage, the knowledge, and the skill required to find and to produce petroleum. So the government, under a new law signed by President Truman on August 8th, has offered an incentive to the industry to make a complete test of the public domain, recognizing the hazards and the great expense involved in drilling 10,000 feet and more to the deep horizons that now must be pierced. Congress has said to the industry that instead of charging high royalties, ranging from 12.5% to 32%, it will be content to exact only a flat royalty of 12.5% on all production from new discoveries. In other words, it offers a reward. But that is not all. The scientists of the United States Bureau of Mines are now engaged in demonstrating how liquid fuel may be made from coal and oil shale, inexhaustible deposits of which are to be found in the Rocky Mountain West. Partnership between government and industry, that's a good pattern. It will win triumphs in peace as well as victory in war.
Thank you, Senator O'Mahony. We return you to the National Hour in Washington.
87 years ago, we discovered a new frontier deep under the earth of America, and out of the earth flowed a $15 billion industry to serve the world.
In 87 years, we learned that oil was not only a business, but a science.
We learned about waste, and we learned about conservation. We learned the hard way, but we remembered.
We learned that greatest progress could be made when industry, the states, and the federal government worked together.
On the subject of oil, then, our commentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen again next week when our subject will be Labor, USA.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 40th in this series on current national problems. The speakers were Mr. Grover C. Stafford, Mr. Eugene Holman, and Senator Joseph C. O'Mahony of Wyoming. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.